and never may denote no more than 50. I still remember the day I first came across the Internet. It was back in 1993 when I was in high school. I went with a couple of buddies to visit our friend Ido, who is now a computer scientist. We wanted to play table tennis. Ido was already a huge computer fan, and before opening the ping-pong table, he insisted on showing us the latest wonder. He connected the phone cable to his computer and pressed some keys. For a minute, all we could hear was squeaks, shrieks, and buzzes, and then silence. It didn't succeed. We mumbled and grumbled, but Ido tried again, and again, and again. At last, he gave a whoop and announced that he had managed to connect his computer to the central computer at the nearby university. "And what's there on the central computer?" we asked. "Well," he admitted, "there's nothing there yet, but you could put all kinds of things there." "Like what?" we questioned. "I don't know," he said. "All kinds of things." It didn't sound very promising. We went to play ping-pong and for the following weeks enjoyed a new pastime, making fun of Ido's ridiculous idea. That was less than 25 years ago, at the time of writing. Who knows what will come to pass 25 years from now? That's why more and more individuals, organizations, corporations, and governments are taking very seriously the quest for immortality, happiness, and godlike powers. Insurance companies, pension funds, health systems, and finance ministries are already aghast at the jump in life expectancy. People are living much longer than expected, and there is not enough money to pay for their pensions and medical treatment. As 70 threatens to become the new 40, experts are calling to raise the retirement age and to restructure the entire job market. When people realize how fast we are rushing towards the great unknown, and that they cannot count even on death to shield them from it, their reaction is to hope that somebody will hit the brakes and slow us down. But we cannot hit the brakes, for several reasons. Firstly, nobody knows where the brakes are. While some experts are familiar with developments in one field, such as artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, big data, or genetics, no one is an expert on everything. No one is therefore capable of connecting all the dots and seeing the full picture. Different fields influence one another in such intricate ways that even the best minds cannot fathom how breakthroughs in artificial intelligence might impact nanotechnology or vice versa. Nobody can absorb all the latest scientific discoveries. Nobody can predict how the global economy will look in 10 years. And nobody has a clue where we are heading in such a rush. Since no one understands the system anymore, no one can stop it. Secondly, if we somehow succeed in hitting the brakes, our economy will collapse, along with our society. As explained in a later chapter, the modern economy needs constant and indefinite growth in order to survive. If growth ever stops, the economy won't settle down to some cozy equilibrium. It will fall to pieces. That's why capitalism encourages us to seek immortality, happiness, and divinity. There's a limit to how many shoes we can wear, how many cars we can drive, and how many skiing holidays we can enjoy. An economy built on everlasting growth needs endless projects, just like the quests for immortality, bliss, and divinity. Well, if we need limitless projects, why not settle for bliss and immortality, and at least put aside the frightening quest for superhuman powers? Because it is inextricable from the other two. When you develop bionic legs that enable paraplegics to walk again, you can also use the same technology to upgrade healthy people. When you discover how to stop memory loss among older people, the same treatments might enhance the memory of the young. No clear line separates healing from upgrading. Medicine almost always begins by saving people from falling below the norm, but the same tools and know-how can then be used to surpass the norm. Viagra began life as a treatment for blood pressure problems. To the surprise and delight of Pfizer, it transpired that Viagra can also cure impotence. It enabled millions of men to regain normal sexual abilities. But soon enough, men who had no impotence problems in the first place began using the same pill to surpass the norm and acquire sexual powers they never had before. What happens to particular drugs can also happen to entire fields of medicine. Modern plastic surgery was born in the First World War when Harold Gillies began treating facial injuries in the Aldershot Military Hospital. When the war was over, surgeons discovered that the same techniques could also turn perfectly healthy but ugly noses into more beautiful specimens. Though plastic surgery continued to help the sick and wounded, it devoted increasing attention to upgrading the healthy. Nowadays, plastic surgeons make millions in private clinics whose explicit and sole aim is to upgrade the healthy and beautify the wealthy. The same might be happening with genetic engineering. If a billionaire openly stated that he intended to engineer super-smart offspring, imagine the public outcry. But it won't happen like that. We are more likely to slide down a slippery slope. It begins with parents whose genetic profile puts their children at high risk of deadly genetic diseases. So they perform in vitro fertilization and test the DNA of the fertilized egg. If everything is in order, all well and good. But if the DNA test discovers the dreaded mutations, the embryo is destroyed. Yet why take a chance by fertilizing just one egg? Better fertilize several, so that even if three or four are defective, there is at least one good embryo. When this in vitro selection procedure becomes acceptable and cheap enough, its usage may spread. Mutations are a ubiquitous risk. All people carry in their DNA some harmful mutations and less than optimal alleles. Sexual reproduction is a lottery. A famous, and probably apocryphal, anecdote tells of a meeting in 1923 between Nobel Prize laureate Anatole France and the beautiful and talented dancer Isadora Duncan. Discussing the then popular eugenics movement, Duncan said, "Just imagine a child with my beauty and your brains." France responded, "Yes, but imagine a child with my beauty and your brains." Well then, why not rig the lottery? Fertilize several eggs and choose the one with the best combination. Once stem cell research enables us to create an unlimited supply of human embryos on the cheap, you can select your optimal baby from among hundreds of candidates, all carrying your DNA, all perfectly natural, and none requiring any futuristic genetic engineering. Iterate this procedure for a few generations, and you could easily end up with superhumans, or a creepy dystopia. But what if, after fertilizing even numerous eggs, you find that all of them contain some deadly mutations? Should you destroy all the embryos? Instead of doing that, why not replace the problematic genes? A breakthrough case involves mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondria are tiny organelles within human cells, which produce the energy used by the cell. They have their own set of genes, which is completely separate from the DNA in the cell's nucleus. Defective mitochondrial DNA leads to various debilitating or even deadly diseases. It is technically feasible with current in vitro technology to overcome mitochondrial genetic diseases by creating a three-parent baby. The baby's nuclear DNA comes from two parents, while the mitochondrial DNA comes from a third person. In 2000, Sharon Saarinen from West Bloomfield, Michigan, gave birth to a healthy baby girl, Alana. Alana's nuclear DNA came from her mother, Sharon, and her father, Paul, but her mitochondrial DNA came from another woman. From a purely technical perspective, Alana has three biological parents. A year later, in 2001, the U.S. government banned this treatment due to safety and ethical concerns. However, on the 3rd of February 2015, the British Parliament voted in favor of the so-called three-parent embryo law, allowing this treatment and related research in the UK. At present, it is technically unfeasible and illegal to replace nuclear DNA, but if and when the technical difficulties are solved, The same logic that favored the replacement of defective mitochondrial DNA would seem to warrant doing the same with nuclear DNA. Following selection and replacement, the next potential step is amendment. Once it becomes possible to amend deadly genes, why go through the hassle of inserting some foreign DNA when you can just rewrite the code and turn a dangerous mutant gene into its benign version? Then we might start using the same mechanism to fix not just lethal genes, but also those responsible for less deadly illnesses, for autism, for stupidity, and for obesity. Who would like his or her child to suffer from any of these? Suppose a genetic test indicates that your would-be daughter will in all likelihood be smart, beautiful, and kind, but will suffer from chronic depression. Wouldn't you want to save her from years of misery by a quick and painless intervention in the test tube? And while you are at it, why not give the child a little push? Life is hard and challenging even for healthy people. So it would surely come in handy if the little girl had a stronger-than-normal immune system, an above-average memory, or a particularly sunny disposition. And even if you don't want that for your child, what if the neighbors are doing it for theirs? Would you have your child lag behind? And if the government forbids all citizens from engineering their babies, what if the North Koreans are doing it, and producing amazing geniuses, artists, and athletes that far outperform ours? And, like that, in baby steps, we are on our way to a genetic child catalogue. Healing is the initial justification for every upgrade. Find some professors experimenting in genetic engineering or brain-computer interfaces, and ask them why they are engaged in such research. In all likelihood, they would reply that they are doing it to cure disease. With the help of genetic engineering, they would explain, we could defeat cancer, and if we could connect brains and computers directly, we could cure schizophrenia. Maybe. But it will surely not end there. When we successfully connect brains and computers, will we use this technology only to cure schizophrenia? If anybody really believes this, then they may know a great deal about brains and computers, but far less about the human psyche and human society. Once you achieve a momentous breakthrough, you cannot restrict its use to healing and completely forbid using it for upgrading. Of course, humans can and do limit their use of new technologies. Thus, the eugenics movement fell from favor after the Second World War, and though trade in human organs is now both possible and potentially very lucrative, it has so far remained a peripheral activity. Designer babies may one day become as technologically feasible as murdering people to harvest their organs, yet remain as peripheral. Just as we have escaped the clutches of Chekhov's law in warfare, we can also escape them in other fields of action. Some guns appear on stage without ever being fired. This is why it is so vital to think about humanity's new agenda. Precisely because we have some choice regarding the use of new technologies, we had better understand what is happening and make up our minds about it before it makes up our minds for us. The paradox of knowledge. The prediction that in the 21st century humankind is likely to aim for immortality, bliss, and divinity may anger, alienate, or frighten any number of people. So a few clarifications are in order. Firstly, this is not what most individuals will actually do in the 21st century. It's what humankind as a collective will do. Most people will probably play only a minor role, if any, in these projects. Even if famine, plague, and war become less prevalent, billions of humans in developing countries and seedy neighborhoods will continue to deal with poverty, illness, and violence, even as the elites are already reaching for eternal youth and godlike powers. This seems patently unjust. One could argue that as long as there is a single child dying from malnutrition, or a single adult killed in drug lord warfare, humankind should focus all its efforts on combating these woes. Only once the last sword is beaten into a plowshare should we turn our minds to the next big thing. But history doesn't work like that. Those living in palaces have always had different agendas to those living in shacks, and that is unlikely to change in the 21st century. Secondly, this is a historical prediction, not a political manifesto. Even if we disregard the fate of slum dwellers, it is far from clear that we should be aiming at immortality, bliss, and divinity. Adopting these particular projects might be a big mistake. But history is full of big mistakes. Given our past record and our current values, we are likely to reach out for bliss, divinity, and immortality, even if it kills us. Thirdly, reaching out is not the same as obtaining. History is often shaped by exaggerated hopes. 20th century Russian history was largely shaped by the communist attempt to overcome inequality, but it didn't succeed. My prediction is focused on what humankind will try to achieve in the 21st century, not what it will succeed in achieving. Our future economy, society, and politics will be shaped by the attempt to overcome death. It does not follow that in 2100, humans will be immortal. Fourthly, and most importantly, this prediction is less of a prophecy and more a way of discussing our present choices. If the discussion makes us choose differently, so that the prediction is proven wrong, all the better. What's the point of making predictions if they cannot change anything? Some complex systems, such as the weather, are oblivious to our predictions. The process of human development, in contrast, reacts to them. Indeed, the better our forecasts, the more reactions they engender. Hence, paradoxically, as we accumulate more data and increase our computing power, events become wilder and more unexpected. The more we know, the less we can predict. Imagine, for example, that one day experts decipher the basic laws of the economy. Once this happens, banks, governments, investors, and customers will begin to use this new knowledge to act in novel ways and gain an edge over their competitors. For what is the use of new knowledge if it doesn't lead to novel behaviors? Alas, once people change the way they behave, the economic theories become obsolete. We may know how the economy functioned in the past, but we no longer understand how it functions in the present, not to mention the future. This is not a hypothetical example. In the middle of the 19th century, Karl Marx reached brilliant economic insights. Based on these insights, he predicted an increasingly violent conflict between the proletariat and the capitalists, ending with the inevitable victory of the former and the collapse of the capitalist system. Marx was certain that the revolution would start in countries that spearheaded the Industrial Revolution, such as Britain, France, and the USA, and spread to the rest of the world. Marx forgot that capitalists know how to read. At first, only a handful of disciples took Marx seriously and read his writings. But as these socialist firebrands gained adherence and power, the capitalists became alarmed. They too perused Das Kapital, adopting many of the tools and insights of Marxist analysis. In the 20th century, everybody from street urchins to presidents embraced a Marxist approach to economics and history. Even die-hard capitalists, who vehemently resisted the Marxist prognosis, still made use of the Marxist diagnosis. When the CIA analyzed the situation in Vietnam or Chile in the 1960s, it divided society into classes. When Nixon or Thatcher looked at the globe, they asked themselves who controls the vital means of production. From 1989 to 1991, George Bush oversaw the demise of the evil empire of communism, only to be defeated in the 1992 elections by Bill Clinton. Clinton's winning campaign strategy was summarized in the motto, "It's the economy, stupid." Marx could not have said it better. As people adopted the Marxist diagnosis, they changed their behavior accordingly. Capitalists in countries such as Britain and France strove to better the lot of the workers, strengthen their national consciousness, and integrate them into the political system. Consequently, when workers began voting in elections, and labor gained power in one country after another, the capitalists could still sleep soundly in their beds. As a result, Marx's predictions came to naught. Communist revolutions never engulfed the leading industrial powers such as Britain, France, and the USA, and the dictatorship of the proletariat was consigned to the dustbin of history. This is the paradox of historical knowledge. Knowledge that does not change behavior is useless. But knowledge that changes behavior quickly loses its relevance. The more data we have and the better we understand history, the faster history alters its course, and the faster our knowledge becomes outdated. Centuries ago, human knowledge increased slowly, so politics and economics changed at a leisurely pace too. Today, our knowledge is increasing at breakneck speed, and theoretically we should understand the world better and better. But the very opposite is happening. Our newfound knowledge leads to faster economic, social, and political changes. In an attempt to understand what is happening, we accelerate the accumulation of knowledge, which leads only to faster and greater upheavals. Consequently, we are less and less able to make sense of the present or forecast the future. In 1016, it was relatively easy to predict how Europe would look in 1050. Sure, dynasties might fall, unknown raiders might invade, and natural disasters might strike. Yet it was clear that in 1050, Europe would still be ruled by kings and priests, that it would be an agricultural society, that most of its inhabitants would be peasants, and that it would continue to suffer greatly from famines, plagues, and wars. In contrast, in 2016, we have no idea how Europe will look in 2050. We cannot say what kind of political system it will have, how its job market will be structured, or even what kind of bodies its inhabitants will possess. A brief history of lawns. If history doesn't follow any stable rules, and if we cannot predict its future course, why study it? It often seems that the chief aim of science is to predict the future. Meteorologists are expected to forecast whether tomorrow will bring rain or sunshine. Economists should know whether devaluing the currency will avert or precipitate an economic crisis. Good doctors foresee whether chemotherapy or radiation therapy will be more successful in curing lung cancer. Similarly, historians are asked to examine the actions of our ancestors so that we can repeat their wise decisions and avoid their mistakes. But it almost never works like that, because the present is just too different from the past. It is a waste of time to study Hannibal's tactics in the Second Punic War so as to copy them in the Third World War. What worked well in cavalry battles will not necessarily be of much benefit in cyber warfare. Science is not just about predicting the future, though. Scholars in all fields often seek to broaden our horizons, thereby opening before us new and unknown futures. This is especially true of history. Though historians occasionally try their hand at prophecy, without notable success, the study of history aims above all to make us aware of possibilities we don't normally consider. Historians study the past not in order to repeat it, but in order to be liberated from it. Each and every one of us has been born into a given historical reality, ruled by particular norms and values, and managed by a unique economic and political system. We take this reality for granted, thinking it is natural, inevitable, and immutable. We forget that our world was created by an accidental chain of events, and that history shaped not only our technology, politics, and society, but also our thoughts, fears, and dreams. The cold hand of the past emerges from the grave of our ancestors, grips us by the neck, and directs our gaze towards a single future. We have felt that grip from the moment we were born, so we assume that it is a natural and inescapable part of who we are. Therefore, we seldom try to shake ourselves free and envision alternative futures. Studying history aims to loosen the grip of the past. It enables us to turn our head this way and that, and begin to notice possibilities that our ancestors could not imagine, or didn't want us to imagine. By observing the accidental chain of events that led us here, we realize how our very thoughts and dreams took shape, and we can begin to think and dream differently. Studying history will not tell us what to choose, but at least it gives us more options. Movements seeking to change the world often begin by rewriting history, thereby enabling people to reimagine the future. Whether you want workers to go on a general strike, women to take possession of their bodies, or oppressed minorities to demand political rights, the first step is to retell their history. The new history will explain that our present situation is neither natural nor eternal. Things were different once. Only a string of chance events created the unjust world we know today. If we act wisely, we can change that world and create a much better one. This is why Marxists recount the history of capitalism, why feminists study the formation of patriarchal societies, and why African Americans commemorate the horrors of the slave trade. They aim not to perpetuate the past, but rather to be liberated from it. What's true of grand social revolutions is equally true at the micro level of everyday life. A young couple building a new home for themselves may ask the architect for a nice lawn in the front yard. Why a lawn? Because lawns are beautiful, the couple might explain. But why do they think so? It has a history behind it. Stone Age hunter-gatherers did not cultivate grass at the entrance to their caves. No green meadow welcomed the visitors to the Athenian Acropolis, the Roman capital, the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, or the Forbidden City in Beijing. The idea of nurturing a lawn at the entrance to private residences and public buildings was born in the castles of French and English aristocrats in the late Middle Ages. In the early modern age, this habit struck deep roots and became the trademark of nobility. Well-kept lawns demanded land and a lot of work, particularly in the days before lawnmowers and automatic water sprinklers. In exchange, they produced nothing of value. You can't even graze animals on them, because they would eat and trample the grass. Poor peasants could not afford wasting precious land or time on lawns. The neat turf at the entrance to chateaux was accordingly a status symbol nobody could fake. It boldly proclaimed to every passer-by, "I am so rich and powerful, and I have so many acres and serfs, that I can afford this green extravaganza." The bigger and neater the lawn, the more powerful the dynasty. If you came to visit a duke and saw that his lawn was in bad shape, you knew he was in trouble. The precious lawn was often the setting for important celebrations and social events, and at all other times was strictly off-limits. To this day, in countless palaces, government buildings, and public venues, a stern sign commands people to keep off the grass. In my former Oxford college, the entire quad was formed of a large, attractive lawn, on which we were allowed to walk or sit on only one day a year. On any other day, woe to the poor student whose foot desecrated the holy turf. Royal palaces and ducal chateaux turned the lawn into a symbol of authority. When, in the late modern period, kings were toppled and dukes were guillotined, the new presidents and prime ministers kept the lawns. Parliaments, supreme courts, presidential residences, and other public buildings increasingly proclaimed their power in row upon row of neat green blades. Simultaneously, lawns conquered the world of sports. For thousands of years, humans played on almost every conceivable kind of ground, from ice to desert. Yet in the last two centuries, the really important games, such as football and tennis, are played on lawns. Provided, of course, you have money. In the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, the future generation of Brazilian football is kicking makeshift balls over sand and dirt. But in the wealthy suburbs, the sons of the rich are enjoying themselves over meticulously kept lawns. Humans thereby came to identify lawns with political power, social status, and economic wealth. No doubt that in the 19th century, the rising bourgeoisie enthusiastically adopted the lawn. At first, only bankers, lawyers, and industrialists could afford such luxuries at their private residences. Yet when the Industrial Revolution broadened the middle class and gave rise to the lawnmower and then the automatic sprinkler, millions of families could suddenly afford a home turf. In American suburbia, a spick-and-span lawn switched from being a rich person's luxury into a middle-class necessity. This was when a new rite was added to the suburban liturgy. After Sunday morning service at church, many people devotedly mowed their lawns. Walking along the streets, you could quickly ascertain the wealth and position of every family by the size and quality of their turf. There is no surer sign that something is wrong at the Joneses than a neglected lawn in the front yard. Grass is nowadays the most widespread crop in the USA, after maize and wheat. And the lawn industry, plants, manure, mowers, sprinklers, gardeners, accounts for billions of dollars every year. The lawn did not remain solely a European or American craze. Even people who have never visited the Loire Valley see U.S. presidents giving speeches on the White House lawn, important football games played out in green stadiums, and Homer and Bart Simpson quarreling about whose turn it is to mow the grass. People all over the globe associate lawns with power, money, and prestige. The lawn has therefore spread far and wide, and is now set to conquer even the heart of the Muslim world. Qatar's newly built Museum of Islamic Art is flanked by magnificent lawns that hark back to Louis XIV's Versailles much more than to Harun al-Rashid's Baghdad. They were designed and constructed by an American company, and there are more than 100,000 square meters of grass in the midst of the Arabian desert require a stupendous amount of fresh water each day to stay green. Meanwhile, in the suburbs of Doha and Dubai, middle-class families pride themselves on their lawns. If it were not for the white robes and black hijabs, you could easily think you were in the Midwest rather than the Middle East. Having heard this short history of the lawn, when you now come to plan your dream house, you might think twice about having a lawn in the front yard. You are, of course, still free to do it. But you are also free to shake off the cultural cargo bequeathed to you by European dukes, capitalist moguls, and the Simpsons, and imagine for yourself a Japanese rock garden, or some altogether new creation. This is the best reason to learn history, not in order to predict the future, but to free yourself of the past and imagine alternative destinies. Of course, this is not total freedom. We cannot avoid being shaped by the past. But some freedom is better than none. A gun in Act One. All the predictions that pepper this book are no more than an attempt to discuss present-day dilemmas and an invitation to change the future. Predicting that humankind will try to gain immortality, bliss, and divinity is much like predicting that people building a house will want a lawn in their front yard. It sounds very likely. But once you say it out loud, you can begin to think about alternatives. People are taken aback by dreams of immortality and divinity, not because they sound so foreign and unlikely, but because it is uncommon to be so blunt. Yet, when they start thinking about it, most people realize that it actually makes a lot of sense. Despite the technological hubris of these dreams, ideologically they are old news. For 300 years, the world has been dominated by humanism, which sanctifies the life, happiness, and power of Homo sapiens. The attempt to gain immortality, bliss, and divinity merely takes the long-standing humanist ideals to their logical conclusion. It places openly on the table what we have for a long time kept hidden under our napkin. Yet I would now like to place something else on the table. A gun. A gun that appears in Act One to fire in Act Three. The following chapters discuss how humanism, the worship of humankind, has conquered the world. Yet the rise of humanism also contains the seeds of its downfall. While the attempt to upgrade humans into gods takes humanism to its logical conclusion, it simultaneously exposes humanism's inherent flaws. If you start with a flawed ideal, you often appreciate its defects only when the ideal is close to realization. We can already see this process at work in geriatric hospital wards. Due to an uncompromising humanist belief in the sanctity of human life, we keep people alive till they reach such a pitiful state that we are forced to ask, what exactly is so sacred here? Due to similar humanist beliefs, in the 21st century we are likely to push humankind as a whole beyond its limit. The same technologies that can upgrade humans into gods might also make humans irrelevant. For example, computers powerful enough to understand and overcome the mechanisms of aging and death will probably also be powerful enough to replace humans in any and all tasks. Hence, the real agenda in the 21st century is going to be far more complicated than what this long opening chapter has suggested. At present, it might seem that immortality, bliss, and divinity occupy the top slots on our agenda. But once we come nearer to achieving these goals, the resulting upheavals are likely to deflect us towards entirely different destinations. The future described in this chapter is merely the future of the past. That is, a future based on the ideas and hopes that dominated the world for the last 300 years. The real future, that is, a future born of the new ideas and hopes of the 21st century, might be completely different. To understand all this, we need to go back and investigate who Homo sapiens really is, how humanism became the dominant world religion, and why attempting to fulfill the humanist dream is likely to cause its disintegration. This is the basic plan of the book. The first part of the book looks at the relationship between Homo sapiens and other animals, in an attempt to comprehend what makes our species so special. Some readers may wonder why animals receive so much attention in a book about the future. In my view, you cannot have a serious discussion about the nature and future of humankind without beginning with our fellow animals. Homo sapiens does its best to forget the fact, but it is an animal. And it is doubly important to remember our origins at a time when we seek to turn ourselves into gods. No investigation of our divine future can ignore our own animal past, or our relations with other animals, because the relationship between humans and animals is the best model we have for future relations between superhumans and humans. You want to know how superintelligent cyborgs might treat ordinary flesh and blood humans? Better start by investigating how humans treat their less intelligent animal cousins. It's not a perfect analogy, of course, but it is the best archetype we can actually observe rather than just imagine. Based on the conclusions of this first part, the second part of the book examines the bizarre world Homo sapiens has created in the last millennia and the path that took us to our present crossroads. How did Homo sapiens come to believe in the humanist creed, according to which the universe revolves around humankind, and humans are the source of all meaning and authority? What are the economic, social, and political implications of this creed? How does it shape our daily life, our art, and our most secret desires? The third and last part of the book comes back to the early 21st century. Based on a much deeper understanding of humankind and of the humanist creed, it describes our current predicament and our possible futures. Why might attempts to fulfill humanism result in its downfall? How would the search for immortality, bliss, and divinity shake the foundations of our belief in humanity? What signs foretell this cataclysm, and how is it reflected in the day-to-day decisions each of us makes? And if humanism is indeed in danger, what might take its place? This part of the book does not consist of mere philosophizing or idle future-telling. Rather, it scrutinizes our smartphones, dating practices, and job market for clues of things to come. For humanist true believers, all this may sound very pessimistic and depressing. But it is best not to jump to conclusions. History has witnessed the rise and fall of many religions, empires, and cultures. Such upheavals are not necessarily bad. Humanism has dominated the world for 300 years, which is not such a long time. The pharaohs ruled Egypt for 3,000 years, and the popes dominated Europe for a millennium. If you told an Egyptian in the time of Ramses II that one day the pharaohs will be gone, he would probably have been aghast. How can we live without a pharaoh? Who will ensure order, peace, and justice? If you told people in the Middle Ages that within a few centuries God will be dead, they would have been horrified. How can we live without God? Who will give life meaning and protect us from chaos? Looking back, many think that the downfall of the pharaohs and the death of God were both positive developments. Maybe the collapse of humanism will also be beneficial. People are usually afraid of change because they fear the unknown. But the single greatest constant of history is that everything changes. Part 1. Homo sapiens conquers the world. What is the difference between humans and all other animals? How did our species conquer the world? Is Homo sapiens a superior life form, or just the local bully? 2. The Anthropocene. With regard to other animals, humans have long since become gods. We don't like to reflect on this too deeply, because we have not been particularly just or merciful gods. If you watch the National Geographic Channel, go to a Disney film, or read a book of fairy tales, you might easily get the impression that planet Earth is populated mainly by lions, wolves, and tigers, who are an equal match for us humans. Simba the Lion King holds sway over the forest animals. Little Red Riding Hood tries to evade the big bad wolf. And little Mowgli bravely confronts Shere Khan the tiger. But in reality, they are no longer there. Our televisions, books, fantasies, and nightmares are still full of them. But the Simbas, Shere Khans, and big bad wolves of our planet are disappearing. The world is populated mainly by humans and their domesticated animals. How many wolves live today in Germany, the land of the Grimm brothers, Little Red Riding Hood, and the big bad wolf? Less than 100. And even these are mostly Polish wolves that stole over the border in recent years. In contrast, Germany is home to 5 million domesticated dogs. Altogether, about 200,000 wild wolves still roam the earth, but there are more than 400 million domesticated dogs. The world contains 40,000 lions, compared to 600 million house cats, 900,000 African buffalo, versus 1.5 billion domesticated cows, 50 million penguins, and 20 billion chickens. Since 1970, despite growing ecological awareness, wildlife populations have halved, not that they were prospering in 1970. In 1980, there were 2 billion wild birds in Europe. In 2009, only 1.6 billion were left. In the same year, Europeans raised 1.9 billion chickens for meat and eggs. At present, more than 90% of the large animals of the world, that is, those weighing more than a few kilograms, are either humans or domesticated animals. Scientists divide the history of our planet into epochs such as the Pleistocene, the Pliocene, and the Miocene. Officially, we live in the Holocene epoch. Yet it may be better to call the last 70,000 years the Anthropocene epoch, the epoch of humanity. For during these millennia, Homo sapiens became the single most important agent of change in the global ecology. This is an unprecedented phenomenon. Since the appearance of life, about 4 billion years ago, never has a single species changed the global ecology all by itself. Though there had been no lack of ecological revolutions and mass extinction events, these were not caused by the actions of a particular lizard, bat, or fungus. Rather, they were caused by the workings of mighty natural forces such as climate change, tectonic plate movement, volcanic eruptions, and asteroid collisions. Some people fear that today we are again in mortal danger of massive volcanic eruptions or colliding asteroids. Hollywood producers make billions out of these anxieties. Yet in reality, the danger is slim. Mass extinctions occur once every many millions of years. Yes, a big asteroid will probably hit our planet sometime in the next 100 million years, but it is very unlikely to happen next Tuesday. Instead of fearing asteroids, we should fear ourselves. For Homo sapiens has rewritten the rules of the game. This single ape species has managed within 70,000 years to change the global ecosystem in radical and unprecedented ways. Our impact is already on a par with that of ice ages and tectonic movements. Within a century, our impact may surpass that of the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That asteroid changed the trajectory of terrestrial evolution, but not its fundamental rules, which have remained fixed since the appearance of the first organisms 4 billion years ago. During all those eons, whether you were a virus or a dinosaur, you evolved according to the unchanging principles of natural selection. In addition, no matter what strange and bizarre shapes life adopted, it remained confined to the organic realm. Whether a cactus or a whale, you were made of organic compounds. Now, humankind is poised to replace natural selection with intelligent design, and to extend life from the organic realm into the inorganic. Even if we leave aside these future prospects and only look back on the last 70,000 years, it is evident that the Anthropocene has altered the world in unprecedented ways. Asteroids, plate tectonics, and climate change may have impacted organisms all over the globe, but their influence differed from one area to another. The planet never constituted a single ecosystem. Rather, it was a collection of many loosely connected ecosystems. When tectonic movements joined North America with South America, it led to the extinction of most South American marsupials, but had no detrimental effect on the Australian kangaroo. When the last ice age reached its peak 20,000 years ago, jellyfish in the Persian Gulf and jellyfish in Tokyo Bay both had to adapt to the new climate. Yet since there was no connection between the two populations, each reacted in a different way, evolving in distinct directions. In contrast, sapiens broke the barriers that had separated the globe into independent ecological zones. In the Anthropocene, the planet became for the first time a single ecological unit. Australia, Europe, and America continue to have different climates and topographies, yet humans caused organisms from throughout the world to mingle on a regular basis, irrespective of distance and geography. What began as a trickle of wooden boats has turned into a torrent of aeroplanes, oil tankers, and giant cargo ships that crisscross every ocean and bind every island and continent. Consequently, the ecology of, say, Australia can no longer be understood without taking into account the European mammals or American microorganisms that flood its shores and deserts. Sheep, wheat, rats, and flu viruses that humans brought to Australia during the last 300 years are today far more important to its ecology than the native kangaroos and koalas. But the Anthropocene isn't a novel phenomenon of the last few centuries. Already tens of thousands of years ago, when our Stone Age ancestors spread from East Africa to the four corners of the Earth, they changed the flora and fauna of every continent and island on which they settled. They drove to extinction all the other human species of the world, 90% of the large animals of Australia, 75% of the large mammals of America, and about 50% of all the large land mammals of the planet, and all before they planted the first wheat field, shaped the first metal tool, wrote the first text, or struck the first coin. Large animals were the main victims because they were relatively few and they bred slowly. Compare, for example, mammoths, which became extinct, to rabbits, which survived. A troop of mammoths numbered no more than a few dozen individuals, and bred at a rate of perhaps just 2 youngsters per year. Hence, if the local human tribe hunted just 3 mammoths a year, it would have been enough for deaths to outstrip births, and within a few generations the mammoths disappeared. Rabbits, in contrast, bred like rabbits. Even if humans hunted hundreds of rabbits each year, it was not enough to drive them to extinction. Not that our ancestors planned on wiping out the mammoths. They were simply unaware of the consequences of their actions. The extinction of the mammoths and other large animals may have been swift on an evolutionary timescale, but slow and gradual in human terms. People lived no more than 70 or 80 years, whereas the extinction process took centuries. The ancient sapiens probably failed to notice any connection between the annual mammoth hunt, in which no more than two or three mammoths were killed, and the disappearance of these furry giants. At most, a nostalgic elder might have told skeptical youngsters that, when I was young, mammoths were much more plentiful than these days, and so were mastodons and giant elks. And, of course, the tribal chiefs were honest, and children respected their elders. The Serpent's Children. Anthropological and archaeological evidence indicates that archaic hunter-gatherers were probably animists. They believed that there was no essential gap separating humans from other animals. The world, that is, the local valley and the surrounding mountain chains, belonged to all its inhabitants, and everyone followed a common set of rules. These rules involved ceaseless negotiation between all concerned beings. People talked with animals, trees, and stones, as well as with fairies, demons, and ghosts. Out of this web of communications emerged the values and norms that were binding on humans, elephants, oak trees, and wraiths alike. The animist worldview still guides some hunter-gatherer communities that have survived into the modern age. One of them is the Nayaka people, who live in the tropical forests of South India. The anthropologist Danny Nave, who studied the Nayaka for several years, reports that when a Nayaka walking in the jungle encounters a dangerous animal such as a tiger, snake, or elephant, he or she might address the animal and say, "You live in the forest. I too live here in the forest. You came here to eat, and I too came here to gather roots and tubers. I didn't come to hurt you." A Nayaka was once killed by a male elephant they called the elephant who always walks alone. The Nayakas refused to help officials from the Indian Forestry Department capture him. They explained to Nave that this elephant used to be very close to another male elephant with whom he always roamed. One day the Forestry Department captured the second elephant, and since then the elephant who always walks alone had become angry and violent. How would you have felt if your spouse had been taken away from you? This is exactly how this elephant felt. These two elephants sometimes separated at night, each walking its own path, but in the morning they always came together again. On that day, the elephant saw his buddy falling, lying down. If two are always together and then you shoot one, how would the other feel? Such an animistic attitude strikes many industrialized people as alien. Most of us automatically see animals as essentially different and inferior. This is because even our most ancient traditions were created thousands of years after the end of the hunter-gatherer era. The Old Testament, for example, was written down in the first millennium BC, and its oldest stories reflect the realities of the second millennium BC. But in the Middle East, the age of the hunter-gatherers ended more than 7,000 years earlier. It is hardly surprising, therefore, that the Bible rejects animistic beliefs, and its only animistic story appears right at the beginning as a dire warning. The Bible is a long book, bursting with miracles, wonders, and marvels. Yet the only time an animal initiates a conversation with a human is when the serpent tempts Eve to eat the forbidden fruit of knowledge. Bilam's donkey also speaks a few words, but she is merely conveying to Bilam a message from God. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve lived as foragers. The expulsion from Eden bears a striking resemblance to the agricultural revolution. Instead of allowing Adam to keep gathering wild fruits, an angry God condemns him to eat bread by the sweat of your brow. It might be no coincidence, then, that biblical animals spoke with humans only in the pre-agricultural era of Eden. What lessons does the Bible draw from the episode? That you shouldn't listen to snakes, and it is generally best to avoid talking with animals and plants. It leads to nothing but disaster. Yet the biblical story has deeper and more ancient layers of meaning. In most Semitic languages, Eve means snake, or even female snake. The name of our ancestral biblical mother hides an archaic animist myth, according to which snakes are not our enemies, but our ancestors. Many animist cultures believed that humans descended from animals, including from snakes and other reptiles. Most Australian Aboriginals believed that the rainbow serpent created the world. The Aranda and Dieri people maintained that their particular tribes originated from primordial lizards or snakes, which were transformed into humans. In fact, modern Westerners too think that they have evolved from reptiles. The brain of each and every one of us is built around a reptilian core, and the structure of our bodies is essentially that of modified reptiles. The authors of the Book of Genesis may have preserved a remnant of archaic animist beliefs in Eve's name, but they took great care to conceal all other traces. Genesis says that, instead of descending from snakes, humans were divinely created from inanimate matter. The snake is not our progenitor. He seduces us to rebel against our heavenly father. While animists saw humans as just another kind of animal, the Bible argues that humans are a unique creation, and any attempt to acknowledge the animal within us denies God's power and authority. Indeed, when modern humans discovered that they actually evolved from reptiles, they rebelled against God and stopped listening to him, or even believing in his existence. Ancestral needs. The Bible, along with its belief in human distinctiveness, was one of the byproducts of the agricultural revolution, which initiated a new phase in human-animal relations. The advent of farming produced new waves of mass extinctions, but more importantly, it created a completely new life form on Earth, domesticated animals. Initially, this development was of minor importance, since humans managed to domesticate fewer than 20 species of mammals and birds, compared to the countless thousands of species that remained wild. Yet, with the passing of the centuries, this novel life form became dominant. Today, more than 90% of all large animals are domesticated. Alas, domesticated species paid for their unparalleled collective success with unprecedented individual suffering. Although the animal kingdom has known many types of pain and misery for millions of years, the agricultural revolution generated completely new kinds of suffering that only became worse over time. To the casual observer, domesticated animals may seem much better off than their wild cousins and ancestors. Wild boars spend their days searching for food, water, and shelter, and are constantly threatened by lions, parasites, and floods. Domesticated pigs, in contrast, enjoy food, water, and shelter provided by humans, who also treat their diseases and protect them against predators and natural disasters. True, most pigs sooner or later find themselves in the slaughterhouse. Yet, does that make their fate any worse than the fate of wild boars? Is it better to be devoured by a lion than slaughtered by a man? Are crocodile teeth less deadly than steel blades? What makes the fate of domesticated farm animals particularly harsh is not just the way they die, but above all, the way they live. Two competing factors have shaped the living conditions of farm animals from ancient times to the present day: human desires and animal needs. Thus, humans raise pigs in order to get meat, but if they want a steady supply of meat, they must ensure the long-term survival and reproduction of the pigs. Theoretically, this should have protected the animals from extreme forms of cruelty. If a farmer did not take good care of his pigs, they would soon die without offspring, and the farmer would starve. Unfortunately, humans can cause tremendous suffering to farm animals in various ways, even while ensuring their survival and reproduction. The root of the problem is that domesticated animals have inherited from their wild ancestors many physical, emotional, and social needs that are redundant on human farms. Farmers routinely ignore these needs without paying any economic penalty. They lock animals in tiny cages, mutilate their horns and tails, separate mothers from offspring, and selectively breed monstrosities. The animals suffer greatly, yet they live on and multiply. Doesn't that contradict the most basic principles of natural selection? The theory of evolution maintains that all instincts, drives, and emotions have evolved in the sole interest of survival and reproduction? If so, doesn't the continuous reproduction of farm animals prove that all their real needs are met? How can a pig have a need that is not